topic tonight for the last week of Seaborology is the needs of the few. Now, this actually was not the topic I was going to speak about tonight. I had a different topic in mind. But then I gave a shiur on Shabbos over at the Associated, and it occurred to me as I was actually giving the shiur that it fit in, what I was developing there, fit in very well with what I wanted to say tonight. So I had to add some things, tweak it a little bit. But it worked so well as part of this general theme of halacha and social science and the building of community that I'm going to use this instead. And the other shiur about tzedakah and the needs of the community will be one that'll just have to wait for another time. But the title I put on here is The Needs of the Few, and that's shorthand for when the needs of the many are the needs of the few. And I believe this is a critical point about our families, about our communities, that really bears discussion. The localized point from which we're going to expand is the issue of hostage negotiations, prisoner exchanges, how do we handle the ransoming of captives, pidyon shvuyim, and that's our starting point, which will take us to a general communal lesson. We begin, actually, even before that, with the concept of altruism. Evolutionary biologists deal with the problem of altruism. How is it that altruism survives within a community? Altruism meaning a person who acts for the benefit of others and not for any apparent personal benefit. That's how we're defining altruism. So altruism theoretically harms the individual. If I give that which I have to somebody else, then I now have less, and others have more. Further, if I'm altruistic and others are not altruistic, I'm going to get burned. We talked about this a little bit in food sharing, where we said that I might share my food with others in the hope that they're going to reciprocate when I need, but I have no guarantee. So altruism harms the individual, at least potentially. But on the other hand, altruism helps the community. Communities with altruists in them are more likely to survive than communities in which it's every man for himself. When it's every man for himself, then there's strife, then people die, people aren't able to contribute to the community. You need altruism for the sake of the community. So the question is, how is it that altruism persists? Theoretically, the scientists assume altruism can be reduced to genes and nature, so those who are altruistic should disappear, because they get taken advantage of by others, and therefore they should die out, and we should be left with selfish people. Now, the cynic might say, yes, and there you go, that explains the world in which we live. But it's not true. It's not true in human beings, it's not true in animals, even. There is altruism out there, the idea that you give to somebody else without apparent personal benefit. So the evolutionary biologists have come up with two popular theories. One is called group selection. The idea that traits persist because they benefit the group, even if they don't benefit the individual, through genetically based interactions of individuals. The way that things work out between parties, we're not going to do this in depth now. You can go home and look up group selection on Wikipedia, and you can find a whole bunch of articles to read. But the idea is that there are pre-programmed interactions between individuals which will actually cause altruism to win out because it helps the group. Magic, it sounds like to me. But that's the idea. There's a second philosophy, which is a little more clear, called the kin selection. And the idea is that people will engage in behaviors that benefit the reproduction of their kin. And as long as you have enough kin, then that group will persist, and you will engage in altruistic behavior towards them because you view them as an extension of yourself. And so that's a second explanation. But the way that I would like to look at it, if not, you know, in the overall evolutionary process, but in terms of intelligent beings, is that people are capable of deciding that the good of the many often lies with the good of the few. Meaning, I have an incentive to act altruistically toward others so that I can feel confident that others will do the same for me. Sort of like the reciprocity theme that we talked about in food sharing. But the idea is that I know that because I help others in need, therefore, I know that when I'm in need, they'll help me. It's sort of the underpinning of the welfare state, when you think about it, right? The idea that I will pay tax dollars so that other people can have health care when they need it, because I want to know that other people are going to pay their tax dollars so that I can have health care when I need it. That's basically the logic that we're talking about, and it comes up in issues of hostage ransoming in Judaism. So, first of all, who's the first hostage in Jewish history? First hostage in Jewish history. Sarah, when? That's interesting. I hadn't thought about Sarah in that context. I suppose she is a hostage, though. I mean, Paro doesn't think she's a hostage. He doesn't think he's taking a hostage. He thinks that... Yes. Right, Abraham treats it that way. Right. Can we find a case that's a little more explicit and where the person is actually taken as a hostage? Not Tamar. You think of Dina. Right. But Dina is not originally taken as a hostage, right? She's originally taken, it appears, by Daber Alev Hanara. He persuades her to come to him. How about Lot? Right? Lot is a prisoner of war. He's going to be apparently sold as a slave. And Abraham's decision to pursue him is effectively a refusal to negotiate. Right? Abraham declares he's not going to negotiate with terrorists, and he instead launches a commando raid and collects Lot. So there you have a case in which there is a hostage, and the hostage is being held apparently for ransom, and the decision by Abraham is, I'm not going to ransom him. Instead, I'm going to go to war, and I will collect Lot. That's the idea. You see the case that I'm talking about. Later, you could argue Shaul tries to avoid being taken hostage. But as you move forward in Jewish history beyond Tanakh, we find other hostage-taking scenarios. During the period of the Roman persecution, we find the Romans would capture Jews and then sell them on the slave market. We're going to get to a story a little bit later that's about that. The people were not taken to be killed. They were taken to be sold. They could just as easily be sold to the Jews if the Jews chose to ransom them. Otherwise, they'd be sold somewhere else. You move forward in history to the period of the Crusades, and you find King Philip Augustus of France imprisoning Jews and holding them for ransom, and then on the other hand, expelling Jews and saying, well, they can only be brought back in if you pay a ransom. Two different types of hostage taking, I suppose. In the year 1286, the Maharam of Rotenburg is perhaps the most famous hostage in Jewish history. The Maharam is the leading authority in Germany of his day. And he and a group of followers try to flee persecution in Germany. And he is caught and imprisoned in a fortress. And the Jewish community wants to ransom him, and he refuses to allow them to do so. He rules, you're not allowed to ransom me. And so he dies, in fact, in the fortress. And they end up ransoming his body after he's already dead. They move forward again in history. You get to 1471 and King Alfonso of Portugal, who captures 250 Jews in North Africa who had been up for sale into slavery, and he ransoms them to Don Isaac Abarbanel. Abarbanel raises the money to have them ransomed. Interestingly, Rabbi Yosef Caro, writing in his Beit Yosef, refers to the Abarbanel as Hanesher HaGadol, the great eagle. And some suggest it's referring to the eagle's protective wings, that he was the protector of these Jews. He arranged for them to be ransomed. The 1648-1649, we find Jews being ransomed after they're taken captive by the Cossacks. We move forward into the Holocaust era, and you have a whole new realm of ransoming, where basically people could be killed, taken to work camps and the like, but Jews had the opportunity sometimes to ransom them. Then the modern age, in the age of terror, in which they don't talk necessarily about ransoming people for money as much as they talk about ransoming people for lives. Right? Free this list of terrorists and then we'll free so-and-so. So then in the year 1970, there's a hijacking of an airliner and Rav Yitzchak Huttner is on the airplane and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky rules that you're not allowed to ransom him. You're not permitted to ransom Rav Huttner. We have, of course, the most famous cases now, the last few years, with Goldwasser and Regev first, and then now with Gilad Shalit. and the issue of how do we handle these types of exchanges. And all of this is going to come back to the point that we made at the beginning, that the needs of the few sometimes are the needs of the many. So far, so good?
What about Munich with the Olympics?
Right. There you have a classic case as well, although there it ends up botched by the German military when they go in and try to save the athletes. I want to stipulate two things in order for us to proceed with this. Number one is what I brought you in source number one, the Rambam's halacha in Matnos Aniyim, the laws of the gifts for the needy, where the Rambam calls Pidyon Shvuyim, redemption of captives, the greatest mitzvah. And you can see it there for yourself. We don't need to read through it in depth. But he quotes numerous psukim to the effect of that you're obligated to do what you can to free captives. And he concludes by saying, "Ein lecha mitzvah rabba kepidyon shvuyim." There is no such thing as another mitzvah that's as great as pidyon shvuyim, as redeeming captives. So, number one, its importance is clear. Number two is that, in general, if I have to choose between my life and the life of any other individual, my life comes first. Unless you're talking about me actively killing the other person in order for me to survive, right? Shvichut damim is one of those that we say, yehareg val yavor, right? I'm not allowed to kill somebody in order to survive. But barring actively killing somebody, my life precedes his. If you take a look on the sheet, it's source number two. You find the classic story in which Rabbi Akiva presents this halacha. If two people were traveling, one of them holding a pitcher of water, and the result of both drinking would be that they would both die, right? You have two people, A and B, who are traveling. A is holding water. If A shares it with B, they're both dead. How do we know that? We don't. This is a hypothetical. But in the realm of hypotheticals, so yes, they know that they can't both drink and survive. If one would drink, if A, who is holding the water, drinks, then he'll reach civilization. Or if he gives all the water to B, then B will reach civilization. So Ben Petura taught, better for both to drink and die, rather than for one to see the other die. That's Ben Petura's ruling. He says you can't watch somebody else perish. However, Rabbi Akiva taught it's not true. The Torah says, V'chei achicha imach, the life of your brother shall be with you. That means your life precedes that of your brother. You come first, and you don't save somebody else if that means that you won't survive. So Rabbi Akiva makes the remarkable statement, it's a strong statement, that you don't save somebody else if it's going to mean surrendering your life. I say it's a remarkable statement because I have a very hard time imagining someone actually drinking and watching somebody else die of thirst. But that's why this is occurring in hypothetical land, where everybody acts according to the principles that we set out for them, and they all know the information that we set out for them, and all that. In reality, I would suspect, and in some ways hope, that people wouldn't actually carry this out. But that's the statement, and so we stipulate two things. One, the critical importance of redeeming captives, and number two, the fact that if it's my life against somebody else's individual life, my life comes first. Now we get into the question of what we're willing to do in order to redeem captives. And you see I put three questions on the page. Question number one, do the needs of the community trump the needs of the individual? And we'll come back to that question in a moment to explain how that applies here. It's not the way it looks. Number two, do we expect our soldiers to accept this possibility of capture without redemption, as a standard risk? Is it any different for civilians? What should civilians expect? And then number three, the point that I made in the beginning, perhaps the needs of the individual are also the needs of the community. And now we'll come back and look at the first question. Do the needs of the community trump the needs of the individual? If I just word the question that way, what's the answer? Yes. Right? The answer is yes, if you word it that way. Do the needs of the community trump the needs of the individual? The answer is yes. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Their line appears in different ways in various sources. But that's what I would assume. Why? Why should that be so? Think about it. I'm an individual. You are a community. Okay, there are four sitting there. There is one sitting right here. Individual versus community. You're telling me community comes first. I'm the individual. You know what I'm going to argue? It's not one versus many. It's one versus one. One versus one. One versus one. One versus one. And so on, you know, around the many people filling the room. The idea is, I argue, it's one versus one for each of us. And therefore, it's not a whole equation of many versus one. It's actually a whole set of one versus one equations. And since in the one versus one equation, my life comes first, there's no reason I should endanger myself in order to save you. You follow the argument? Assuming that I'm the one who has the means of making the decision. Let's say, for example, it's the water discussion. Or the water discussion is very hard to fit into the paradigm of many and few, because my needs aren't going to be the same as the community's needs. But let's pretend they are. Let's pretend that the same amount of water is needed to save my life as is needed to save everybody's life. So, you told me that the community matters more than I do. Therefore, I should give you the water so that four people will survive instead of one person. Right? That's the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few, right? My answer will be no, because my life versus your life, my life comes first. My life versus your life, my life comes first, and so on down the line. I should win in each one-on-one. How do you assume that the community actually means more than the individual? So the answer lies in the case of Sheva bin Bichri. And the idea is, I'll explain the theme first, and then we'll see the application. We don't view community as a set of individuals. The instinct that you had that made you say community wins is correct, because community is not four individuals. Community is an entity. It's a mega individual that carries greater weight than any one individual does. Proof of it is found in the Torah. In all levels of social responsibility, I am responsible for the... Sorry? Shmuel Bey's meeting? Oh, you're looking at that case. But before we even get there, in the Torah's narrative in general, in terms of collective reward and punishment, as we find throughout the Torah, in terms of arevut, my joint responsibility for others, for the rest of the community, in terms of tzedakah, we have an obligation towards those around us. We don't view them as individuals. We view them as part of a broader community. And we look at the Sheva bin Bichri case, at least to start. Sheva bin Bichri rebelled against David HaMelech. This is a very bad idea. If you can look at the list of things in Tanakh that you don't want to do, rebelling against David HaMelech is very high on the list. We get the story here in source number 3. The troops, led by General Yoav, came and besieged Sheva bin Bichri in a town called Avel Beit Macha. They set up a mound against the city, and it stood in the moat, and that way they're going to enter the city, and all the people with Yoav battered the wall to knock it down. Then, a wise woman cried out of the city. "Hear, hear, say," she says. She says, "I beg you, Yoav, come near that I may speak with you." And he came near, and the woman said, "Are you Yoav?" And he answered, "I am." And she said, "Listen up." And he said, "I hear." And she spoke, saying, "You know, Avel Beit Macha, this town that you're invading, is not just some little village. Avel Beit Macha is a serious city. It's a term, the term that she uses is Ir Va'im Bi Yisrael, a city and a mother in Israel." She says, people used to say, let's go seek advice at Avel. You can see the translation there. And that was how they ended matters. They would look for advice. They would come to our city. We're peaceful. We're loyal. Do you really want to destroy Ir Va'im Bi Yisrael? You want to destroy a city in Israel? All to get at this guy Sheva bin Bichri? Why would you swallow us up? What did we do wrong? So Yoav said, "No, never. God forbid. I wouldn't do that. But there's this fellow Sheva, and there's a warrant out on his head. And he's there in your town. Deliver him, and I'll depart from the city." So the woman is in the situation of the needs of the individual, Sheva, and the needs of the city. So what does she do? The woman said to Yoav, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." It doesn't say how long she thought about it either. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom. They cut off the head of Sheva, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Yoav. And that's it. The siege is over. Yoav goes back to David HaMelech. Mission accomplished. That would seem to indicate, assuming the old woman is right, that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. However, it's not necessarily so. Not necessarily true. They try to quote that case in this discussion about hostages. Take a look at source number 4, passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi. We learned, if groups of people were traveling on the road, and they encountered non-Jewish bandits, they happen to not be Jewish in this story, but it doesn't really matter for our purposes, who said, "Give us one of yours, and we will kill him. And if you don't, then we'll kill all of you." Now, what that means is, they said, "Give us anyone." Okay, there are 10 of us. And they said, "You can hand over whoever you want, but we need one. And we're going to kill whoever it is. And if you don't, then we'll kill out all of you." They, even if all would be killed, they should not give over anyone. If the attacker specified a victim such as Sheva ben Bichri, like happened in Yoav's case, where he said, "I want that one," then the group should give him over and not be killed. Then they do turn him over, like what the old woman said, right? Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, "Not so fast. Only if the victim is liable for death, like Sheva ben Bichri." And Rabbi Yochanan said, "No, that's not true. Even if he's not liable for death like Sheva ben Bichri, even still, if they name the person they want, you hand them over." That would seem to prove that individual versus community, community wins. Where they didn't name someone at all, it's not our right to pick somebody and say, "He's going to go." But if they pick someone, then we turn him over. Does this prove that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few? Is this an adequate proof, or is there a problem here? If I'm asking the question, the answer is there's a problem here. Come on, what's the problem? Think. Tell me something. What are the possible outcomes of this case? Outcome number one, you turn him over. He dies, the rest of them go free. Outcome number two, you don't turn him over, they're all dead, including him anyway. Right. He is, as they say, a dead man walking. That's why this case doesn't work as a proof. He's dead anyway. The only question is whether they're all going with him or not. Assuming that, you can trust murderous bandits in the first place. There's a certain suspension of disbelief here. But this is not an adequate proof, because he's gone no matter how you slice it. So we need to look at a second case, which is much better as proof. Source number 5, a Mishnah in Gittin. Ein podin es hashvuyah in yaser al kedei demeyan mipnei tikkun ha'olam. One may not redeem captives for more than their value, due to tikkun ha'olam, the need to repair the world, meaning that there is a need for us to take care of society. So don't pay more than the value of the person being held. What is the person's value? Remember that the Mishnah is during the Roman era when Jews are being taken captive and sold on the slave market. The answer is what you would get on the slave market. That's his value. So you can't pay more than the market rate for this person who's been taken captive. Why? Mipnei tikkun ha'olam. What does that mean? To repair the world for the sake of the community. What do we mean? Take a look at source number 6. And the Gemara offers two possibilities. Does tikkun ha'olam refer to the burden upon the community? That's one possibility. If you are going to pay more than the person's going rate on the market, then the community is going to go bankrupt trying to ransom people because the bandits will name any number they want and you'll have to pay it. And we're going to go fundraising and knocking on doors and everything else in order to raise the money. That's one possible explanation. Or, second possibility, to a concern that the captors may capture and bring more captives. You're giving them an incentive. If the captors know that they can get any amount of money that they want, then they're going to go take more people captive. That's what they do. Right? That's the business that they're in. That's a second possibility. Two possible reasons. One, so as not to inspire more kidnapping. Or actually, number one was not to bankrupt the community. Number two is so as not to inspire more kidnapping. That's our question. Which is it? To which the Gemara says, well, let me bring you a proof from a story. Levi Bar Darga redeemed his daughter for 13,000 gold dinar. Tosfos and Bava Basra points out that when you see a number, 12,000 or 13,000 in the Gemara, it means a really, really, really large number. It doesn't necessarily mean someone counted out 13,000, but the point is, he paid an exorbitant sum way beyond the market rate. That's why they bring it as a proof. So they say, well, look, he paid a huge amount of money, but he did it himself. So that tells me that the concern that we have is really the concern of bankrupting the community. And there he says, well, I'm not bankrupting the community, I'm paying it myself. No one else will have to bear the burden. You follow? If the concern is they're going to take more captives, then Levi isn't allowed to do this, even if he pays it himself. The only justification for Levi doing this is if our concern was we don't want the community to have to pay it, then the community didn't. He did it himself. So does that prove that our concern really is the burden on the community, and we don't redeem individual captives because it's a huge burden on the community? The community outweighs the individual? To which the Gemara says, not necessarily, because Abaye argues and says, who says the sages agreed with this? Perhaps he did it against the desire of the sages. Perhaps Levi Bar Darga went out to redeem her, and he saw a chacham along the way, and the chacham said, no, you're not allowed to do that. And he said, who in the world do you think you're kidding? This is my daughter. Right? You think he stopped and said, well, is this mutter or usser? No, it was his daughter. He went out and he gave them the money and he got his daughter back. This really isn't a proof of anything. But the point in our discussion isn't necessarily even the reason for redeeming or not redeeming. The point is the fact that we're willing to make this calculation and say, don't redeem them for more than the going rate, because it's bad for the community. Either in terms of bankrupting the community, or in terms of the fact that other people could get taken hostage. The fact that the Gemara makes this calculation tells me that community outweighs individual. To apply it to our hostage discussion then, community outweighs individual. You don't say, I'm going to harm the community by releasing terrorists paying exorbitant sums in order to free the hostage. So far. We ain't done yet, but so far. And to take it back to our point from the beginning, those watching on camera, so this is before the video started, but in terms of the propagation of altruism within a community, this is pushing us to say the community's needs come first, way before the needs of the individual. The community has to come first, and the community should not surrender its assets in order to help the poor, struggling, needy individual. This is an argument against taxing everybody in order to save one person, in order to help one person. Second of our 3 points. Maybe our soldiers, and perhaps even our civilians, should not expect people to save them. Because war is a bria bifnei atzmo, its own entity. Tell me something. The following case. Somebody in shul, God forbid, collapses on Shabbos. He has no pulse. Do we call 911? Absolutely. Why? Because Nefesh overrides Shabbos. Right, we save lives, right? That overrides Shabbos. Separate case. A person is told by the doctor that in order for him to get better, he has to eat chazer. What does he do? He eats chazer. You save a person's life, even at the expense of violating almost any mitzvah in the Torah, correct? Right? We can agree on that? Well, let me ask you a question. We have a mitzvah. This coming week is Parsha Zachor. We have a mitzvah of going to war against Amalek. There is a mitzvah for the Jews when they enter into Israel to fight wars against the seven nations, assuming they don't make peace, assuming they don't agree to the Noahide mitzvah, and all of that. There's an obligation to go to war. You know what happens in war? Exactly, people die. You're telling me I should break Shabbos in order to save a life. You're telling me I should eat treif in order to save a life. But now, I should risk my life for the mitzvah of going to war? Since when does going to war override human life? What's going on? I'm not the first one to ask this question. The Menachas Chinuch raises this point in his commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch. Not necessarily. That's only a war of self-defense. The mitzvah of fighting the war against the seven nations is not about saving the community. It's true, you're right, if it's a self-defense war, but they aren't all self-defense wars. Take a look, please, at source number 7. In a remarkable concept, the conclusion that the Menachas Chinuch comes to in dealing with this problem. He says, granted that all mitzvos are overridden in the face of danger, still, the Torah instructed us to do battle for this mitzvah, the mitzvah of dealing with the seven nations. It is known that the Torah will not depend upon miracles. It's not as though we expect we'll go to war and no one's going to die, as explained by Ramban. And it is normal for people to be killed on both sides in a war. Right? Our assumption is not that no one is going to die. And so we see that the Torah decrees to do battle despite the danger. If so, then the concern for danger is overridden in this case. In a wartime situation, you are expected to know, going in, that death can happen. And maybe the argument should be, the soldiers know that it could be, they're going to be taken captive. It's the price of doing business. That's the way it is. And the argument may even be made regarding civilians. Now, it's trickier regarding civilians because of the problem of quantifying unconventional war. Meaning you're dealing with a terror situation like we deal with today. Is it war? Is it not war? In an article on a separate discussion about the status of enemy civilians and collateral damage, Rabbi Yitzhak Blau pointed out that it's a little difficult to consider Israel today as a nation at war. He said, if we really believe that this is a war, then why do Israelis hire Palestinian workers to do all sorts of jobs? Right? Well, because I need my building to be completed, right? I need someone to pick the produce, whatever it is. Okay, but then you can't tell me that he's an enemy combatant at the same time. We don't hire enemy combatants. So it's not so clear that you could actually call this a state of war. But the point is that maybe the argument should be soldiers agree to a level of risk when they enter battle. Now, when I gave this shiur, or a little bit of variation on it at any rate, this past Shabbos, so someone pointed out that you do have to distinguish between conscripted armies and volunteer armies. It's one thing to say when you have volunteers to the army that they accept a certain degree of risk. It's another thing if people are drafted and they don't have a choice. And you could say, well, they had a choice about not living in that country altogether, I suppose. They could have moved. But for many people, that's not a realistic option. So therefore, it's not so clear that they accepted this upon themselves. In the context of the Menachas Chinuch, it is, because there it's an issue of a mitzvah, and you can't. We're not going to tell people you have an option of opting out of Judaism. That's not what we present to people. But in any case, we've presented two arguments for pushing for the needs of the community and saying we're not going to ransom the hostages. However, there's a very significant counterpoint. And that goes back to our point from the beginning about altruism. After we talked about group selection, and after we talked about kin selection, we presented a third explanation for why altruism might persist within a community. And that is, it's in the best interests of the community to devote its resources to saving the individual, to saving the few. Rav Chaim David Halevi made this point regarding the military situation and regarding soldiers who have been taken captive. It's important for us to inspire confidence in soldiers as well as citizens, for them to know that they aren't going to be left alone. It's important that they know we're going to do everything we can to save them. That gives them the confidence to carry out the missions they need to carry out. There is the possibility of arguing the needs of the few are the needs of the many. We have proof of this, going back to that Gemara in Gittin regarding ransoming captives. Take a look, please, at source number 9. And the story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah. I only translated one line because I only had room on the page for that. I didn't want to go on to a third page. So I'll tell you the story outside. The story was that Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, who was known in the Gemara for his interactions with the Romans, in general with Roman society, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya goes to Rome, and he hears that there's a Jewish child there being held prisoner, who is a beautiful child, and the commentaries on this talk about his beauty as being an analogy for his learnedness, his scholarship. But Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya says, let me go see. And so he goes to the prison, and he has a little test. He announces a pasuk from Yeshayah. Mina sam l'mishisa Yaakov Yisrael lebozezim. Who gave Yaakov over to being despoiled? And the kid responds with the rest of the pasuk. Halo Hashem zucha tanu lo. This is Hashem who did it. We sinned to him. Lo avu b'drachav aloch. The Jews didn't go in his ways. Lo shamu b'tarazo. The Jews didn't listen to his Torah. Omar, he said, Yeshua Hananya hears this, and he says, oh boy, Muvdechani bo shemora hora b'Yisrael. I believe that this child is going to grow up to be a tremendous posek. You could read it as, he believes the child is right now giving a psak. He's saying, we are in the position we're in because we've sinned. But his point is, this child has the potential for greatness. And so he says, I'm going to redeem him b'chom mamon sheposkin olav, for whatever sum they demand. And in fact, that's what he did. He redeemed him for a tremendous sum of money, and the kid grows up to be Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. There are two, possibly three Rabbi Yishmael ben Elishas in the Gemara. Tosos in, I think it's Yavama, to the Yavamas or Yoma, discusses this. But one of them we know is the Kohen Gadol in the Beis HaMikdash. The other one that we know of for sure is the sparring partner of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva always argues with Rabbi Yishmael, and there may be a third as well. But in any case, this child grows up to be the great Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya is apparently unaware of source number 5 that says you can't redeem people for more than their value. What's his justification? So Tosfos in source number 10 offers us two answers. One answer is that it may have been a life and death situation. Perhaps he knew the child was not going to be sold as a slave, but instead his life was in danger. But then Tosfos offers a second answer. Alternatively, Tosfos says, Inami, it was because he was superlative in his wisdom. The kid was so great that he would have tremendous value to the community. And therefore, it would be worthwhile for the community to ransom him. Now, that was raised in the discussion about ransoming Reputner in 1970. That was raised in the discussion about ransoming Maharam Meirotenberg. Those are both beyond the scope of the discussion right now. But the point is, it could be in the best interests of the community to save a particular individual because of the value he has for the community. And you can apply that to the soldier case. It's worthwhile for us to retrieve this person, even at a great price, because of what it will do for our society in general. That may be the reason why altruism survives in a society. Because we recognize that ultimately it's better to have everybody committed to helping one person, so that each of us knows that when we are the one person, we will benefit as well. This has tremendous applications. One ramification of all of this, the idea that we stated in the beginning, of looking at society not as a set of individuals, but rather as a collective, has ramifications in the sense that we look at ourselves not as a set of separate people, but as a community. You think of building the Mishkan, the theme of giving the half shekel, right, being part of a tzibur. But number two, it means that we recognize that helping individuals is helping the community. So we have our Torah-sanctioned support for the indigent and the needy, economically needy, socially needy, and our mandate that we use our resources to aid each individual, even past the point where it makes economic sense, is also something that is a big issue for rabbis, speaking from my own experience in the shul rabbinate. I gave a Daf Yomi shiur in Allentown, and we had 10, 12, 13, I don't know how many people we had that were part of the Daf Yomi. You have 220, 230 families in a shul. You're putting a lot of energy into a relatively small group. And it's the hour that you give the shiur. You know, if you have someone who's giving the shiur who actually takes the time to prepare it, it's even more time, right, invested in that. That's time that's not going into the rest of the community. How do you justify it? Or you have somebody who's going through a loss, or somebody who's going through a tough counseling situation and they need a lot of your time. well, that time that isn't going to other people. Can the rabbi justify that kind of an investment? I believe the answer is yes. Because it's important for every member of the community to know that if, God forbid, it's ever him, if he's ever the one in that situation where he needs the time of the rabbi, and it's not just the rabbi, it's community workers in general. But everybody knows, if they're ever the one on the hot seat, they will have someone they can go to who will give them all of the time that's needed in order to solve the problem. That's the key. And so that brings us full circle back to the point of altruism in terms of today, but the broader discussion that we've had for the last 7 weeks about the creation of community, about tziborology. Right? We spent a couple of weeks looking at sort of the limits of tzibor in the beginning. Right? We talked about the shuls reaching a certain size and saying, well, at a certain point, the social network breaks down. Right? We talked about it from that perspective. We talked about how we try to improve that a little bit within that series, and then also when we talked about food sharing and how we use food to bring people together. We talked about it in terms of tefillah, in terms of our davening and the merit of davening as a community. We talked about it in terms of trust and trying to build trust within the community. And this is a very important piece, the idea that the entire community will see its mandate as helping the individual so that everybody feels that they fit within the community as a whole. All right? Thank you very much.